Welcome to Understand Suicide, the podcast of journalist and therapist Paola Fontanelli. Since her father's suicide in 2005, Paola has dedicated her life to breaking the silence around this most stigmatized of subjects. Her book, Understanding Suicide, Living with Loss, Paths to Prevention, was nominated for the National Book Award in Brazil, and the English edition is now available on Amazon.
Hey everyone, just quickly before I start the interview, which I'm sure you will enjoy. It's been a great interview and it's so rare that I talk to two members of the same family. But before we do that, I just wanted you to know that May is the Mental Health Awareness Month. So because of that, I have lowered the price of my course, How to Help Suicidal People. So if price was a problem for you, take advantage of this month until the end of the month. Instead of $379, it will cost you $59.90. So just go to understandsuicide.com and click on course, and you'll have all the information you need. Thank you.
Welcome again to my podcast and my YouTube channel. Today we have mother and daughter with us. It's a very special episode for me because Thea actually contacted me through the website. And she told me that she had just lost her father a few months ago by suicide. And I remember thinking, Thea, when I read your email, first of all, my first reaction was, wow, that's very raw. It's very recent. And I worry as a therapist that every time I have someone contact me, and I've had this happen in the past, someone contact me, they want to be on the podcast, but then I talk to them and said, no, this is going to be re-traumatizing. I'm not going to do that. And it's very hard to say no, but that's what I did to you. I didn't say no, but I said, okay, let's talk. I just want to see where you are. And that's what we did. A few days later, we had a conversation and I realized that you were ready. You had put a lot of thought into it. You were emotional, of course, but naturally emotional. But the one thing that really made me decide for yes was when you said, how about if my mom participates? So to me, I felt, okay, that's an extra layer of support for you. And that's what really made me comfortable saying yes, because I know it's recent and it's recent for both of you. Of course, it's a loss that you're sharing. We were talking before starting to record, and I was talking to Jean and I said, wow, you have a very unconventional situation and relationship here, because it's not one of those conventional families. They have a mom and dad and they live together. Sometimes they separate. No, this started very unconventionally. Jean met Brian many, many years ago, over 30 years ago. They lived in a commune. So I want to start there with you, Jean, because I think it gives us a very important and precious, in a way, background of what happened, of who Brian was, the kind of relationship that you had with him, and the kind of relationship that co-parenting brought to both of you. So can you just talk about Brian, the Brian that Thea partially knew, but there is another part of him that only you know. So tell us a little bit of how you met and how this story began.
Okay. I met Brian when I was 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And I was searching for something meaningful to do with my life. I knew that I wanted to live on a commune, and I knew that I wanted to learn how to grow food. And my mother had found a colleague of hers. My mom is a social worker. A colleague of hers had read an ad for a farming apprenticeship in the Chicago Reader. And it turns out that Thea's father had written this ad and decided to advertise to find apprentices to come to this commune in California, in mm-hmm. Southern California. He decided, let's run an ad in Chicago. So when I called the commune, it was called Zendik Farm. Mm-hmm. I spoke with him. We all changed our names at Zendik Farm, and Brian was named Chen. So that was from the I Ching. He was.
So it's important to say you called, and the first person who picked up was him.
Yes. Was him. So you talked to him.
The first conversation ever with the commune was him.
And I was 18. And I possibly felt a deeper connection with him in that phone call on kind of a worldview level than I had ever felt with anybody in my life. Hmm. He said to me, well, you know that human beings are destroying the earth, right? And well, we're here on this commune trying to do something about that. Wow. And that was straight to my heart.
That's values, right? Values.
That's it. Yeah. And it was exactly what was concerning me at 18. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to do something about it. You know, the destruction of our environment. We just spoke the same language. Mm-hmm. And then I remember I got off the phone. I talked to my mom and we said, well, what if it's a cult? So I called him back with like 20 questions. Uh-huh. And at the end of asking him the questions, Brian said to me, you know, you sound like an intelligent person. You can come out for the apprenticeship. It's, you know, 2-3 months. But if you don't like it here and it's not for you, you'll leave. Mm-hmm. So, you know, come check it out.
Guess it's not a cult then.
That's right. And then when I got to California, he picked me up mm-hmm. at the bus stop and he pulls up, you know, cut off jean shorts, very California, long blonde hair, you know, muscles, sort of this tie-dye shirt, but very muted colors. And mm-hmm. I just immediately thought, that is the coolest person I've ever met in my life. And then I thought, I wonder if all the guys are going to be this.
I am not leaving this commune ever.
No, it was like, I don't know. He just had an energy to him, mm-hmm. especially in his prime. Mm-hmm. You know, he took his life when he was 67. I met him when he was 32. He's 14 years older than me. He was the presence you felt in the room. He's a Midwestern boy, high school quarterback, president of his student council, you know, leader.
A leader. Yeah, for sure.
He was very funny. He had a very athletic sort of embodied way of being in his body.
Like, a lot of like prowess, I would say, but he wasn't primping himself, you know, he mm-hmm. just,
he didn't come off cocky.
No,
there was just a big presence whenever you were around him that made you feel really good.
That's uh-huh. right. You know, we would say he was like a silverback gorilla, you know. That's it. He had a very unique quality. He cared not for money and material goods. He was an incredibly deep, philosophically minded man. But therefore, when he related to you, to another person, it felt like he was talking to your essence.
Yeah, and he was entirely there.
Caring for your essence. He wasn't really noticing. He might say to you, oh God, you look great today. You just look great. But he didn't mean, oh, your outfit really looked or your hair was done recently. He meant what you were emanating from the inside out.
You were shining and glowing.
Your soul was shining. He could see that in people. Oh. And so, I mean, I could go on and on.
Yeah.
Anyways.
But from what you say, I can also tell that this is a person who was deeply connected and very sensitive to everything, right?
And that was it, which of course... Mm-hmm. It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah. Feels a lot, right? Feels deep.
Feels a lot. He was, you know, we all know that the numbers of species extinction and air and water pollution and, you know, methane gas release. I mean, we're all aware of this, but mm-hmm. most of us can kind of compartmentalize it. Brian couldn't. It was in his cells. He constantly was aware of what was really happening. That was something he struggled with as long as I knew him. There was a history of suicidal ideation and mental illness in his family. Yeah. So, you know, that's something that was always palpable in knowing Brian, you know, was his struggle inside of his head.
And this was a struggle that, as you said, since the beginning, it was always there. I mean, this sense of I'm doing my part, but still the earth is being destroyed, and still he was feeling it very deeply.
Absolutely. And I would say the other part of the struggle in his mind really had to do with love and intimacy. And Theo was by far the most precious being to him on the planet. And I believe he was closer to her than he was to any other human being. But he carried some wounds and fears within himself that manifested as an immense, he did not see himself clearly. He did not know how wonderful and lovable and valuable he was, no matter how we tried to convince him. And that aspect of his personality was something that I experienced firsthand, you know, from when I was 18 or 19, very early on. But I will say that even though he struggled so and had so much negative self-talk, to me, he was always just so compelling, irresistible as a friend, as a person to make a child with.
How long did you stay with the commune?
I was there 17 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
And left when he was 50. So he, how many years?
He went there when he was 27. So
wow,
he
23.
Yeah. Years. And then there are a couple other people in our lives closely who were also at the commune with us, which is my husband, Verdon.
My stepdad.
Yeah. Also known as half daddy sometimes. After we left the commune, which we did when Theo was 2 3/4, not quite 3, Theo was sort of raised in a sense communally after the commune.
Wow. That's, oh, I wish more of us were, right? We talk about it takes a village, right? But how many people have access to that village? And right. It sounds like you did.
Yes. Yeah, I did. And it's been nice now going through this that I have kind of a second dad, you know, in my stepdad. And then also that we have this best friend, Cord, who my mom mentioned. He was actually there, you know, 5 minutes after I got to my dad's house on the day he died. So we've been there the whole time. And I'm just so lucky to have those two kind of male figures in my life as I go through this.
And also my parents are still alive. They're in their early 80s and a huge part of Fia's life as well. And my support system too. So,
but yeah. I don't want to pry, but I kind of need to. I want to ask you, how was it that you guys made this decision? Let's have a child together. Must have been, I don't know. I'm just assuming here, yeah. But it just sounds like a beautiful moment.
It was a beautiful moment. I can, you know, share, you know, I think on the most essential level, I really loved Brian deeply from when I met him. It was not, the primary part of our relationship was a deep friendship and caring for each other and a deep understanding of each other. You know, at times we had a more romantic or sexual intimate relationship, but that was never really the primary energy between us. We were colleagues who shared a vision of work that was important to us that we both cared about a lot. But he got it into his head that he wanted to have a child and he wanted to have a child with me. And that sounded good to me. You know, my, I wanted to do that. And I loved so many things about him. You know, I think that I felt that, like I said, I'd never, this was a one in a million man, a very extraordinary human being who really lived his own way. Mm-hmm. And that I wanted to mate with him and make a child with him, you know, to carry forward what was so amazing about him. And Thea does embody many of his best qualities.
Okay, so, let me go to Thea now. So what are these qualities that you embody? You say?
No idea. No idea.
Not the right person to ask, huh? Well, I have to say that I don't know you, of course, but the fact that you contacted me, and that shows bravery too. That shows not only that, but something that comes from both your parents, is this idea of, let me help somebody else. If I can share my story, and that's what you told me, I know it. And I remember you even said when you wrote to me first, you said, I know it's very early, but I feel that I'm ready to do this. And I feel that I can help somebody with my testimonial. So that's I'm sure, something that comes from both your parents. They were both people of conviction and values, but this communal spirit that they had, you do have it in you. So thank you for doing this. And I know it's not easy. You were just telling me before we started recording and getting ready for this, that it's been a tough few days because it was your dad's birthday. Was it last week?
Yeah, it was a week ago from today.
And of course, dates, that's what they do, right? In grief, we come back to the lows and then kind of climb hardly up. So how are you doing today, Thea? And how have these past few months been for you?
I think so today I'm feeling the grief is not in my face today. I'll put it that way. As time has passed since he died, I've obviously had life responsibilities kind of come back and have had to become more busy. And so that often puts the grief kind of just to the side because I have to focus externally on all these responsibilities. So today was a busy day and it wasn't up in my face. But the past few months have been completely grueling, and the hardest work I've ever done in my life, and the deepest pain I've ever felt. And I think because it's only been maybe 3.5 months, I still deal with so much shock at different times. I'll be like, oh my gosh, that really happened. And my dad really did that, because that's not really how I experienced him to be. And yeah, it's something that, you know, I never obviously saw coming at all. And it's been just so deeply challenging, but I am okay. I am definitely okay. And I know that, and I feel that. So I'm just trying to really listen to myself and ride the waves as they come and set low expectations for myself of what I'm going to demand of myself and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. When you say that's not what I experienced him to be, so tell me about your father.
Yeah, I mean, my dad was just kind of, the only way I could describe it is the best. He was just the best. And him and I, we had very similar interests, and we had a part of ourselves that was just so similar. Like, I'm really similar to my mom, but there was kind of this other part of me that I always felt like my dad was kind of the only one who I really shared that with and who really understood that kind of certain feeling in me. I just didn't experience him to be that dark or that troubled or that mentally ill, I guess. I definitely experienced him to be less, less troubled than he really was. It didn't cross my mind that he would do that. It didn't cross my mind consciously. Sure. I think it did unconsciously.
Do you have a friend or a loved one who struggles with suicidal thoughts, ideation, or even previous attempts? If you do, I have some information for you. I know that the situation is scary, and many times we want to do the best we can to help, but we don't know how. Over the course of my 15 years working in this field, I have learned how to address these issues, and that's what I want to share with you. And for that, I have just created an online course that will guide you step by step on how to sit down and have this difficult conversation. The course is called How to Help Suicidal People, and I purposely took a very straightforward approach so that when you finish, you will feel prepared to take action in a safe, non-judgmental, and compassionate way. You will learn about the mental state of a suicidal person, how it impacts the way they view their personal crisis, how to bring hope into the conversation, how to prepare yourself to listen to them, especially when they talk about their emotional pain, how to create a safety plan, how to assess their risk level, and much, much more. The course comes in 6 modules and it's all videos with very simple language and reading materials for quick reference. If you think that this course is for you, click on the link on my notes or go to my website, understandsuicide.com, and click on the course tab. There, you can also watch a free sample and have more information about the course. Thank you. Yeah, in the last few months of his life, or maybe a couple of years, I want to go back to Gene. Did you see it coming at all? Because Thea said no, it was a big surprise for her. But as you said, I mean, you knew this wounded part of Brian that it, I'm sure he kept inside, because from what you say.
You know, let's see. In the 35 years that I knew Brian, I think that there were 2 or 3 times when I knew that he was seriously contemplating taking his life. Mm-hmm. And at different times participated in some form of an intervention or discussing what could we do. He and I went to therapy together when Thea was about 13 for, I think, 2 years.
Okay.
And he was pretty feeling suicidal at that time. At that time, I really, really begged him to, you know, go on some type of antidepressant, which he did.
Okay.
And our therapist and I both, you know, spoke to him about how devastating that would be to Thea and to us were he to take his life. So mm-hmm. we had even really discussed it.
Okay. So and he verbalized it at the time?
Yes. And you know, as the years went on, you know, I think that he sort of recovered from that very dark period when Thea was about 13. But then I think these past, certainly during COVID, but even, you know, 4 or 5 years, I was always worried about him. And I was always kind of strategizing. You know, I would call his brother and sister, and maybe they would come visit and his spirits would be lifted. Or, you know, consciously, I just thought that he wouldn't take his life and that he absolutely would not do that to Thea and to our family. And I knew he loved us, but on another level, I really did see that he was, his functionality, the negative stories he was telling himself were gaining more and more power. And his ability to kind of function in the world was decreasing. You know, the past couple years, Thea and I took long walks with him along Lake Michigan. You know, we'd walk for a couple hours and it was very joyful. We had a lot of fun and it was kind of magical. It was special. We would have a three-way hug and we'd talk and Thea would tell us all about her classes. But there was a little feeling when I look back now that we were all really cherishing those moments.
Hmm.
We were all so present with our love for each other. And I think there was some sense that it was finite, you know, that I don't know, you know. So his conflict about living as a human on the earth at this time in history, that conflict within him was pretty palpable.
Yeah.
I don't know. There was always this feeling of who would he respect to receive help from?
I see. It's a sense of hopelessness.
Hopelessness paired with arrogance is the wrong word, but he didn't have a lot of respect for a lot of.
Yeah, the system.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it.
So, yeah. I don't know. It complicated. I'm not sure if
it's
I'm.
It's a lot. Yeah, yeah. Thea, do you say that that's not how I experienced him? I didn't realize that maybe he. Did you know, for example, that he had taken medication? And now, in retrospect, do you see it differently?
Yeah, I did know he had taken medication. I knew he struggled with depression, kind of a bipolar situation. And I do see it completely differently now in retrospect. And that's been a big part of my process, is kind of relearning who my dad was after the fact, now that I've kind of gotten this more full picture idea of his life, including the parts that I was maybe protected from by him and my family, rightly so. But I do see it differently. And I think that I, like I said, maybe unconsciously knew that that was something he struggled with, because on the day he died, when I got to his house, I didn't know that it was a suicide. Uh-huh. And there were a bunch of groceries on his front stoop that he had ordered, who knows when, but they were like freshly delivered groceries. And I remember kind of trying to show the police officer, like, look, do you see he just ordered groceries, so it couldn't have been a suicide because he just ordered groceries. So that doesn't make sense. He must have had a heart attack. So I kind of see I somehow had an awareness of that possibility, even though it wasn't really fully conscious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am looking at both of you, and I know from talking to my listeners, there are a lot of parents listening right now, parents who lost another parent and kids, they don't know how to talk to their kids and how to help them. And I see that both of you are going through hell right now, but you are together. You're doing this together. And this is a testament. I mean, doing this podcast together to me just shows how aligned you are. So what would you say to the parents who are listening? And many times I hear them say, I don't know how to talk to my kids, or should we talk to our kids? So I want to hear from both of you. What helps a family heal in a moment like this?
There's so much. I think, yes, you should definitely talk to your kids. I think talking always helps, unless, you know, say, I don't want to talk about it right now. But I think making the effort to check in about it is so, so important, because as you go back into life, it can be easy to kind of not check in, but it's so important to do that. And I think for me, what's really helped from my parents was that they really respected my instincts around everything I wanted to do after the death, be it bury my dad here or in this way, or certain things of his or go to his house, not go to his house. They really let me direct the process so that I could honor what felt best to me instinctually. And then also, I think having my parents, like especially my mom, be honest with me about what she's going through, because if that's not there, if I'm not being let into her grief process, kind of, then if she's trying to protect me from that, then I begin to feel isolated and alone. Like, am I the only one freaking out about this? Mm-hmm. And also my mom allowing me to have my anger and just totally have my process and understanding that we have two different processes. They don't need to be the same. And no one can really tell the other how they should be with this. It's just so individual. Right. And so different, because we had such different relationships with my dad.
Of course.
And we have different bodies and systems. We've also just spent so much time together since it happened. Like, it does not feel good to, I don't live at home with my mom mm-hmm. and my stepdad, but it doesn't feel good to not see each other for a long period of time. Like, we check in over the phone so much every day. I come over to the house almost every day. So just knowing, it's been really important for me to just have people around me as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to have long talks about my dad and process things that happened in his life and things that happened between me and him and my mom and him and hear stories. So just really making time to have long talks about it and him and his death and everything and me and you yeah. and everything. Yeah.
Okay. So what I hear from you is that first be present, no judgment, right? So listen to me and not tell me what to do or what's right and what's wrong, because we know in grief, we hear that a lot. So being present, having her support, and also talking about your dad, his life, not just the way he died, because that's not the whole of your dad, right? And this happens with people who die of suicide. Their whole life is kind of erased and they become the person who took their lives. So that's very important. And also, it sounds to me that it's not that you not over talking, but it's just being ready to talk. If you want to talk, they'll be there. They'll be there too. And if you say, I don't feel like talking, no, let's just talk about something else, right? So really respecting each other's grief and your own process helps.
Okay. Yeah,
absolutely. So.
How about you, Jean? What helps you?
Well, it's interesting. I agree with everything that Thea just said. You know, from the start, Verd, my husband, and Thea's stepdad and I both were pretty clear that, yes, a terrible thing has happened, but we can still, it sounds strange, but do fun things as a family.
Yeah.
And that is really important. So 5 days after Brian took his life, we had a pre-planned trip to California to look at some performing arts high schools for Thea's younger brother. And we thought, are we going to take this trip? And we took it. And Southern California is where I had met Brian. And we had a lot of fun on that trip.
It was so fun. Yeah.
You know, we explored some new towns.
It was a great trip.
We went out to dinner. I mean, we had a lot of laughs.
We met new people.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, that kind of knowing that we can always balance it out with things we already love to do and things that bring us so much joy and we can have fun and...
Right.
And, you know, I think sometimes there's that idea that, well, for example, on that trip, you know, my dad took his life 5 days ago. So I think sometimes we would shut ourselves off from the idea of even having fun on that trip.
Right.
But we kind of had this somehow, this feeling that well, my dad took his life 5 days ago, and it's also possible that I can have a really fun couple hours on this trip.
Right.
And then, you know, maybe I'll have a dip and some cries.
Well, but then, I mean, every night it was like 4 nights.
We slept together.
We were in the same bed and we were crying.
The commune was back, huh?
You know, so.
And then at the same time, having fun. So totally. It was, and that's been a big part of the process for us, is really not capping our joy just because it happened.
That's right. Really
making sure we're connecting with our joy and doing those things that bring that out,
even though
this happened, because we know we can still be happy people.
Giving yourself permission to continue living.
And pretty early on, I started to say to Thea, and I think I say it fairly frequently, like, well, do you have some fun things you want to do on your mind? You should do them, you know, go do some shopping, cook something yummy, I don't know, get a massage. I don't know, sort of extra things, a little more like, let's
pick me up.
Let's make ourselves a nice, matcha latte. I don't know. Just simple pleasures. Like, let's make sure we're, whatever it is, a bath with a nice oil. I don't know. We really honed in on that a little more because certainly our expectations for ourselves of productivity or exercise, or, we've tried to really let a lot of that go. We spend a lot of time in bed, sometimes I love to brush her hair. I love to rub her feet. I don't know. We found things that are deeply connective and nurturing, and we try to do a lot of them,
Yeah. That says a lot about who you are, but also who Brian was, right? Because this was a trio relationship.
Yeah.
And this is something that I'm sure was there present with him too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. And I also think that's part of why it felt so easy to give ourselves permission to experience joy and everything afterwards, because my dad was very kind of focused on not bothering anyone else, as odd as that sounds, because he took his life, but he was very focused on not wanting anyone to go out of their way to do something for him. Or
very self-sufficient, huh?
Yeah, he didn't want to be a burden on anyone. And obviously that kind of had a pathological side to it, but it also had this side that made us feel like we know that there's nothing weighing on us because of this in this way. Like, we're off the hook. There's nothing sticky or entangled that he was experiencing around us.
Absolutely.
So he can just go be free. I
even would say that I felt that he trusted us to go on loving full lives. I felt that often, that he chose his time to leave. It was certainly deeply against our wishes, but at the same time,
it sounds like you respect that too.
That's it. Well, I certainly have felt that, like I said, like Thea said, we each have a different experience of it, but the responsibility to make sure that Thea is as well as she can be. Mm-hmm. I mean, that certainly as a mom has been the most brutal part of it is, Thea is a person with a large capacity for joy to have a good day. Thea has a lot of good days. Mm-hmm. It's just how she's always, her middle name is Day. Brian and I chose that for her because we both like the day. We thought she would like the day, and she does, but to see her have this enormous hole in her spirit from this terrible thing that has happened.
Yeah.
As a mother has caused me an enormous amount of grief and does. it's unfathomable still that we're here talking about this, that this has happened, but at the same time, it has, and we're bringing to bear, as Theo would say, all of our tools for resilience. He used that term, and that is something we are very focused on.
Yeah, and I think one more thing for parents and children would be, it's important to talk about your person and what happened, but it's also important to talk about the way you're experiencing your parent and how their process is affecting you, or how their way of relating to you through this is affecting you. If you're at the age where you can, to kind of say, you know, I need you to do this more, or this less, or this isn't working.
Okay. Advocate for yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've had sort of a push and pull around kind of coming to acceptance.
Okay.
And Thea has said to me, I don't care about that. I'm angry.
Yes.
Okay, right. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So
yeah, I'm so glad you touched on that, because that was going to be my last questions, because it's very different to share sadness and loss from sharing anger. All these emotions that are kind of not acceptable when someone dies, you're not supposed to be angry at them, right? And that's one of the differences with suicide death. So yeah. Do you share that too? I mean, have you felt, because the anger is very common. Do you feel, and do you share that?
Yeah, we've both felt anger at different times intensely. And then I've also had anger at you for things you've said about it, or things you felt about it even. And I've also had so many feelings of guilt and regret, and just so many difficult feelings, that aren't, like you said, that aren't acceptable. Or that might be tougher or less expected, but I think that none of them have been shamed or anything. So the key point.
Absolutely.
Is not shaming a child for whatever they're feeling.
Yeah. And I, you know, when Thea has been very angry at me for things I've said, or for things that I didn't say when I've told her about Brian's life, that has called me to find a new kind of capacity in myself to let her be very angry in general and very angry with me, and not try to take that away, because an awful thing has happened and anger is a legitimate response. Mm-hmm. And our family has to be a home within which, you know, wailing and moaning and hitting and pounding, you know, is part of it. It warrants that level of primal response. And I think we share a belief that releasing on that way, in that way, is very, very important.
Yeah.
To processing it through the body, through the psyche, engaging in that, almost the physical aspect of the hurt, is something that, you know, we do.
Well, Thea and Jean, thank you so much, Thea, for contacting me. This has been, I am sure this is going to help so many families, because suicide breaks families. It does. I'm sure you understand what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You're here, but you are here able to tell your mom, I was angry at you. And just the level of openness and authenticity from both of you is palpable. And it's beautiful to see, because that's what's going to make a difference in the future and in both of your healing processes from now on. It's being able to be there, being able to be angry, being able to feel differently, to be silent and take it in and respect each other. And it's there. And I'm sure that this is going to help so many families know how to deal with this, that is just... there's no words. Suicide, we're silence, right? That's why we silence. We tell people how did they die, suicide, and they go, okay, I'll go do my thing, and they disappear. We lose friends. There's so much silence around suicide, but because it's just, it's against our most human instinct, right? And all these feelings, like Tia said, of guilt and then anger, and how could you? And you said a few times, I didn't think you would do that to her.
Yeah.
This idea that they're doing it to somebody else and not themselves. So anger is, as you said, it's normal. It's a response. That's what it is. And we have to respect that. So I'm so grateful for both of you to help me guide families on how to deal with suicide loss, because it's a tough one. It's tough to understand that people heal differently. Some want to talk, others don't. I had the other day someone call me and said, Paula, I need help. I need to talk to my mom, and she won't talk about it. So I'm glad to see that you both have each other. You have your stepdad. I can see that you're very good at creating strong lifetime relationships, both of you. So just stay with each other, because through the ups and downs of grief, that's basically what you need. And that's nothing else is more important than that. So thank you. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for giving us the space to share.
And for being there for Thea when she found your podcast, because it really helped her very much in the immediate aftermath. As she was trying to find her way, she found you. So thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Understand Suicide, the podcast of journalist and therapist Paula Fontanelli. If you've been touched by suicide and believe your story might help others, please consider contacting Paula through her website, understandsuicide.com.